In 2011, the San Francisco Symphony celebrates its 100th season. Since 1925, the orchestra has been making recordings. I'm Scott Fogelsong, a contributing writer and pre-concert lecturer here at the Symphony. For some years now, I've been exploring the Symphony's long and distinguished history and recorded sound, a vast treasure of music preserved in commercial recordings, in radio broadcasts, and from the Symphony's own archives. I invite you to join me in these podcasts as I share some of my favorite moments drawn from 85 years of great recordings by the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony. On this podcast, we'll be hearing selected passages from individual works as they have been performed by the San Francisco Symphony down the years. A wise man once said that comparisons are odious, and he was right. I don't propose to make value judgments between various conductors and their interpretations. My goal is to point out changes, differences, and similarities. We all have our individual tastes and preferences, after all. I'd like to begin with an in-depth look at the first 80-some-odd measures of one of the most familiar works in the orchestral repertory, the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in C minor. As it turns out, I have in my collection performances from five of the symphony's music directors, Pierre Monteux, Joseph Cripps, Ado de Wart, Herbert Blumstedt, and Michael Tilson Thomas, in a mix of commercial recordings, broadcasts, and live performances. Before hearing the performances, we need to know what it is we're going to be listening for. So here's a guide through those opening 80-some-odd measures of the Beethoven. The opening phrase consists of those famous four notes and their repetition. On the fourth and eighth notes are fermatas, or pauses. The second phrase is an expansion of the first idea. It ends on the second fermata, but this time with most of the instruments silent, except for the first violins, who hold a high G. Then comes the long phrase, extending for almost 40 measures, culminating in the bridge theme. Then comes the second theme, which states its melody first in the violins, then in the clarinets, then in flutes and violins together. And that's where we'll stop. Now for the questions to ask about each of these elements. For the opening phrase. How is it paced? How long are those fermatas? Are they both the same length or different? For the second phrase. Does it seem held back, steady, or pushed forward? This is the moment when the movement's tempo is established, so it's an important question. For the second fermata, is there any holding back before that big fermata? For example, does the conductor push right into it? Something like this. Ya-pa-pa-bum-bum-ba. Or is there some kind of preparation? Like this. Ya-pa-pa-bum-bum-ba. For the long phrase, is it held steady or pushed forward? How does the conductor achieve the long crescendo? What about all of the instrumental detail in the passage? For the bridge theme, is it in tempo or not? How legato or connected is it? Or how etched? That's mostly up to the horn player to decide, but some conductors might have specific ideas as well. For the secondary theme, is it pushed forward? Is it relaxed? There are numerous changes of instrumentation here, from violins to clarinets to flutes and violins together? Are those highlighted or blended? Here's Pierre Monteux, live on a Standard Hour broadcast of February the 16th, 1947. The opening is stately, with long fermatas, and they're both about the same length. The second phrase rushes forward almost breathlessly. There's a sudden slowdown into the second fermata. The long phrase is a headlong lunge, breathless and exhilarating. The bridge and second themes remain in that breathless mode. Here's Joseph Cripps, live on KKHI on December the 7th, 1966. The opening is stately with long fermatas, and the second fermata is longer. The second phrase is deliberate and measured. There's only the barest preparation for the second fermata. The long phrase keeps its cool and stays controlled in a long, gradual crescendo. The bridge theme is sharply etched with a really spectacular burnished horn. The second theme is legato, smooth, and cushioned. Here's Edo DeVart on September the 18th, 1980. You'll note that there's a delighted audience response at the beginning. This was the opening week at Davies Symphony Hall, and I gather that people didn't know precisely what was going to be played. But we all recognize the Beethoven Fifth. The opening pushes forward with short fermatas. The second phrase moves right ahead. There's almost no slowdown into the second fermata. The long phrase is played throughout in a secure tempo, building up gradually with some help from the brass section. The bridge theme is slightly etched in the horn, but not enough to break out of the overall texture. And the second theme is steady and lyrical. Here's Herbert Blomstedt, live on June the 21st, 1986. The opening pushes forward with a somewhat longer fermata at the end. The second phrase is somewhat etched, with each phrase kept separate from the other. There is no slowdown into the second fermata. The long phrase keeps the sections of the orchestra distinct during the long crescendo, with lots of support from the brass. The bridge theme is burnished and bright, picking up from that brass support. The second theme is in the same tempo, and it moves right ahead. Now here's Michael Tilson Thomas's recent album on SFS Media. The performances were recorded in 2010 and the album released in 2011. The opening is grand, with a short first fermata and a longer second one. The second phrase keeps its tempo steady. There's no slowdown into the second fermata, but the long-held high note in the violins connects into the following long phrase. That long phrase is rhythmically accented and creates a unified body of sound rather than highlighting individual instruments. The bridge theme is a grand statement, etched in the first few notes, then luxuriantly legato. The second theme highlights the individual instruments as they play. That was a lot of close analytical listening. But we don't always have to get so technical about it all. Sometimes, we can use much simpler means. Pierre Monteau recorded the Brahms Second Symphony twice with the San Francisco Symphony, first in 1945, then in 1951. It is often said that Monteau was a consistent conductor, generally inclined to perform things the same way over the years. Let's find out. I propose a direct contrast between that 1945 and 1951 recording. We'll take the opening passage of the last movement. The 1945 recording will be heard through your left channel, and the 1951 recording in the right channel. I have ensured that both begin simultaneously and that both are at precisely the same pitch. Now we'll see how long they run before they start drifting out of sync and start sounding like some ghastly avant-garde thing in the process. Now remember, 1945 to your left, 1951 to your right. Here we go. So we made it to about the 40-second mark before the differences became severe. That's pretty good. Most pairs of recordings wouldn't stay on track anywhere near that long. Monta's 1945 finale clocks in at 8 minutes 10 seconds, and that's the single fastest performance I have in my entire collection, whether San Francisco Symphony or not. Monta's 1951 recording runs 8 minutes 25 seconds, a difference of only 15 seconds. Compare that to Joseph Cripps's 1964 broadcast. At 9 minutes 26 seconds, he's obviously going a lot slower. But Seiji Ozawa, in 1973, is closer to Monteux's camp, with a timing of 8 minutes, 51 seconds. By the way, the slowest single performance I have in my collection is Leonard Bernstein's 1983 recording with the Vienna Philharmonic. It clocks in at a leisurely 10 minutes, 17 seconds. We must be careful to avoid stereotyping conductors, however. Unfortunately, that's exactly what I've just done, by supporting two persistent stereotypes. One, that Pierre Monteux conducted fast, and two, that Joseph Cripps conducted slow. Let me see if I can repair the damage I've done. Consider the finale of Mozart's Jupiter Symphony, number 41 in C major. Here's Joseph Cripps in 1963. And here's Pierre Monteux in 1947. The tempi are very close to each other. The most striking difference is in the orchestra's sound itself. Monteux was conducting a lean and mean machine that he had built over 12 years, while Joseph Cripps was at the helm of an ailing orchestra in sore need of rebuilding. If by some sci-fi miracle the two conductors could have swapped orchestras, I think the performances would have remained similar. Another stereotype, and at least this time it's not my fault, is that Ato DeVart tended towards cooler emotional temperatures than his predecessors. But I'm not so sure about that. Consider Carl Maria von Weber's overture to Euryanthe. First up, Pierre Monteux conducts it in 1950, live on a standard hour broadcast. Monteux takes his typically ebullient approach, with his Greyhound lean San Francisco Symphony with him every second. When Josef Krips guest conducted the symphony in 1972 for the observance of his 70th birthday, he was conducting an orchestra that he had rebuilt and that was now achieving great things under his successor, Seiji Ozawa. Krips was no slouch about his tempo in the Euryantha Overture. This performance positively sizzles. Eido Devart? In 1985, he was at the helm of a San Francisco symphony transformed by its move to Davies Symphony Hall. Devart's approach is every bit as committed and bright as his predecessor's, but now with a transparent elegance, partly in the playing and, to be honest here, partly in improved recording technology. Here's the live concert of March 22, 1985. I should mention that Malteux wasn't always the speediest guy around. Consider his 1947 broadcast of Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony from the Saltarello finale, marked Presto. Now hear Herbert Blumstedt conduct the same movement on his 1993 Decca recording, and prepare yourself for a shock, because it's Herbert Blumstedt who sets the speed records here. Thank you. The only faster performance I have of that movement is Claudio Abbado's 1984 Berlin recording, but it's only faster by a whisker. Differences between conductors are fascinating, but the similarities are even more interesting. Sometimes we can reach across the years and hear two kindred spirits at the helm of the San Francisco Symphony. Certainly that's the case with Alfred Herz and Josef Krips, both exemplars of the great Austro-German tradition, and both stunning Wagnerian conductors. In their recordings of the prelude to Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, they demonstrate the longevity of a powerful tradition. On April the 20th, 1926, in the Victor Talking Machine's Oakland studio, Alfred Herz was dealing with a brand new technology, electric recording. Nobody quite knew what to do with microphones yet, but they were learning fast. But the tech doesn't really matter, because Herz knew this music practically at the DNA level, and he had an orchestra for whom Wagner wasn't a figure from the past. For some of the players, Richard Wagner was a living memory, as he was for Herz as well. Here's Herz and the orchestra playing the Tristan Prelude as the music surges towards its magnificent peak. We jump forward almost 40 years to April the 3rd, 1964. Josef Krips is conducting a completely different group of musicians in a different space captured via a different recording technology. But that broad Wagnerian sweep remains the same, despite all those intervening years and cultural changes. That connection over the years could be cross-cultural as well. The two most influential conductors of the San Francisco Symphony during its first half century were Alfred Hertz and Pierre Monteux. Fortunately for us, they recorded a few of the same pieces, and in so doing, showed us clearly that their similarities far outweighed their cultural differences. Here's Hertz conducting Franz Liszt's tone poem Les Préludes in a sonically splendid rendition made in Oakland's Scottish Rite Temple on February 27, 1928. Note the heroism, the big solid brass, the sweep of the thing. Now, here's Pierre Monteux on April 16, 1950, for a Standard Hour broadcast. Audio technology had improved dramatically in the interim, but the stage of the War Memorial Opera House is a much less flattering acoustic space than the Scottish Rite Temple, so I suppose it all evens out. Like Hertz, Monteux aims for the heroic, although his approach is a bit more punchy than broad. The two conductors achieve much the same impact, in my opinion, using slightly different means. One might not think of Pierre Monteux and Herbert Blomstedt as being much alike, but there's a lot more commonality there than you might think. Both conductors are superb exponents of the Austro-German literature, for example, but they tend to be associated with other repertory, Monteux with French music and Blomstedt with Scandinavian composers. But the two meet squarely in regards to certain composers, and none more so than Brahms. One of Monteux's most celebrated RCA recordings is the Brahms Alto Rhapsody, made in 1945 with the legendary American contralto Marian Anderson. It was one of two Monteux albums to be recognized by being released as an RCA Victor showpiece, a special gatefold album with lavish full-color illustrations and text. The performance certainly deserves that royal treatment, warm and rich, but never thick or lugubrious. Here's an excerpt. Herbert Blomstedt gave us an alto rhapsody on a 1990 Decca CD with mezzo-soprano Yard Van Ness. British magazine Gramophone described it as really the best modern version available. Like Monteux, Blomstedt avoids any hint of starchiness, always a danger in this work, with its solid choral underpinning and slow-moving harmonies. Now, you have to adjust for the differences in recording technology, and also make allowances for Van Ness's much lighter voice than Anderson's Mother Earth contralto. Listen past those, and you hear two deeply perceptive musicians who reach securely across 45 years in full agreement on the way to play this late romantic masterwork. I could keep going, and going, and going. But it's time to wrap up this podcast, and with it, my 12-episode series on the San Francisco Symphony's history on record. Even after all these examples, I'm just scratching the surface. All the music I've had to omit for lack of time. The delectable Warrior's March by Rimsky-Korsakov that Malteux tacked onto side one of the 1942 Scheherazade as a little curtain raiser, or Herbert Blomstedt's Mahler Second, or Seiji Ozawa's selections from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, or anything from Michael Tilson Thomas's Charles Ives album on RCA. We didn't hear Monteux's stellar Beethoven Second or Eighth Symphonies, or Herz's gorgeous rendition of the Glazunov Valse de Concert, or Josef Krips and Rolf Persinger playing the spots off the Viola Concerto by San Francisco's own Roger Nixon. But a lot of those recordings are still out there. I went out and looked for them, and so can you. What fun I've had sharing all of this with you. And I hope that someday I might be able to add some new episodes as the symphony's discography continues to expand and evolve. In 1945, Pierre Monteux started a San Francisco symphony tradition by recording Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. He was leading a barely post-war orchestra over a dedicated telephone line to the RCA studios in Los Angeles, where the performance was captured on 78 RPM acetate discs. That's Stone Age technology by our standards. But you know what? They got the point across, as this extract from the very ending makes abundantly clear. Now we leap 54 years into the future. It's 2009, and the San Francisco Symphony has just released its fourth recording of the Symphonie Fantastique. Now, with Michael Tilson Thomas at the head of a world-renowned orchestra, recorded with the crystal clarity of high-definition digital audio. And you know what? They got the point across, too.